He almost thought he could see patterns in the ebb and flow of the marketers, repeating designs, spontaneous shared movements like a flock of birds on the wing. "Jonas?" Brummond nudged him. "What's your poison, old man?" Paul looked up. An aged Nimbor, wearing an incongruous-looking white dinner jacket, was waiting patiently for his order. Without knowing where the idea came from, he asked for a brandy. The Nimbor inclined his head and disappeared on soundless feet.
"You know, of course, that the local brandy is barely fit to hold the name," said Professor Bagwalter. "Still, it's a damn sight better than the local beer."
He fixed Paul with his sharp brown eyes.
"So, what brings you to Tuktu Bim, Mr. Jonas? I asked you if you were Canadian because I thought you might have come in with Lubert on Large Door. They say he's got a lot of Canucks in his crew."
"Blood and thunder, Bags! You're interrogating the poor fellow again," laughed Brummond. He leaned back in his chair as if to leave the field to two well-matched adversaries. Paul hesitated. He didn't feel well-matched at all, and there was something about Professor Bagwalter that made him decidedly uncomfortable, although it was hard to define just what it was. Where Brummond, like Clurew and others he'd met here, seemed as comfortable with life on Mars as a fish in a stream, the professor had a strange edge, a questioning intelligence that seemed out of place. Still, just a few moments of listening to them talk about someone named Lubert in some place called Canada made it clear he would never be able to bluff his way through. I'm not sure how I got here," he said. "I've had a head injury, I think. I found the boy. Actually, I don't remember very well. You'll have to ask him. In any case, there was some trouble. I remember that, and we escaped. First thing I really remember is floundering in the Great Canal."
"Well, doesn't that trump all?"
said Brummond, but he sounded less than astonished, as though this kind of thing happened rather frequently in his vicinity. Bagwalter, on the other hand, seemed quite pleased to have something around which to base an inquiry, and to Paul's discomfort and Hurley Brummond's great disgust, spent the next half-hour questioning him closely. Paul was finishing his second throat-burning brandy, and feeling a little more relaxed when the professor returned to the subject that seemed to interest him most.
"And you say you've seen this Vonari woman before, but you don't remember where or when?"
Paul nodded. "I just... no."
"Maybe she was your fiancée," offered Brummond. "Yes, I'll bet that's it."
After sitting in bored silence for some time, he had suddenly warmed to the subject matter.
"Maybe you were injured trying to protect her from the Sumbar's guards. They're heavy-handed fellows, you know, and pretty nimble with those scimitarish noggin loppers of theirs. That time they were going to pop Joanna into the Sumbar Seraglio, well, I had my hands full, and then some."
"Hurley, I wish—"
the professor began, but Brummond was not to be held back. His blue eyes sparkled, and his golden hair and beard seemed almost to crackle with static electricity.
"Joanna, she's my fiancée, the professor's daughter. I know, damn presumptuous to call one's fiancée's father Bags, but the professor and I had been through a great deal before I ever met Joanna."
He waved his hand.
"She's back at camp with the Temperance right now, laying in supplies for an expeditionary voyage we're going to make to the interior. That's why I chased after you, to tell the truth. If you'd been good old Kedgeri Kirk, I was going to offer you a place in the crew."
"Hurley,"
said the professor with some irritation.
"In any case, it seems like every time I turn around, one of these green-skinned wallahs is trying to abduct Joanna. She's a sturdy gal, and admirable as all get-out, but it's really a bit much. And monsters. I can't tell you how many times I've had to pull her out of some squonch hole or other."
"For goodness sakes, Hurley, I'm trying to ask Mr. Jonas some questions.
Look here, Bags, just for once you've got to let go of all this science twaddle. This poor fellow's fiancée has been kidnapped by the priests, and they're going to sacrifice the girl. They've beaten him so badly that he can hardly remember his own name. And you'd just as soon poke and prod him as offer him any help, wouldn't you?"
"Here now,"
said the professor, taken aback. "I'm not sure," Paul began, but Hurley Brummond stood up, unfolding to the full extent of his impressive height.
"Don't you worry, lad,"
he said, and almost knocked Paul across the table with a comradely crack on the back.
"I'll ask around. There's more than a few, both green and white, who owe a favor to Brummond of Mars. Yes, that's just what I'll do. Bags, I'll meet you both in back of the club at sundown.
He was gone from the room in 3 strides, leaving Paul and the professor almost breathless.
"He's a good lad," Bagwalter said at last. "Tough as nails, and big-hearted, and my Joanna loves him dearly."
He took a sip of his sherry.
"But I do wish sometimes he weren't so damned stupid."
Far across the desert, the sun had almost disappeared behind the distant mountains, going to its rest contented after a long day scorching the upturned face of Mars. The last rays struck crimson glints from all of Tuktu Bim's windows and translucent spires. From the balcony at the back of the Ares Club, Paul stared down the hillside on what seemed to be a vast scatter of rubies and diamonds. For a moment he wondered if this place could be the home he had sought. It was strange, but somehow quite familiar as well. He could not remember where he had been last, but he knew it had been somewhere different. There had been several somewheres in his past, he felt sure, and even without the specific memories, he felt rootless weariness in his bones and thoughts.
"Look at that," said Galley, pointing.
Not far away, a huge flying ship, similar in shape to the ceremonial barges they had seen on the Great Canal, was slowly rising past the tower tops into the evening sky, guide ropes dangling. Hundreds of dark shapes moved on its decks and in the complicated rigging. Lanterns glowed along its length, dozens of bright-burning points. The barge almost seemed to be a living constellation sprung from the vaults of the night. "It's beautiful." Paul looked down. Galley was rapt, wide-eyed, and Paul felt something like pride that he had protected this boy, had brought him safely out of... It was useless. The memory would not come. "It's too bad Clurue didn't stay to see this," he continued, "but I suppose it's all very familiar to him." Clurue of the Fisher People, perhaps feeling he had fulfilled his promise once Paul had discovered other Earthmen, had brought Galley back from the bazaar and then headed off to his shantytown beside the canal. "Still, he was kind to us, and I was sad to see him go."
"He was only a Nimbor," said Galley dismissively.
Paul stared at the boy, who was still raptly watching the airship. The remark seemed oddly out of character, as though Galley had absorbed some of the attitudes of those around him.
"Wind from the desert tonight."
Professor Bagwalter released a thin stream of smoke from his lips, then screwed his cigar back into the corner of his mouth.
"It will be hotter tomorrow."
Paul found that hard to imagine. "I don't want to keep the boy up too late. Do you think Mr. Brummond is going to be here soon?" The professor shrugged.
"You never can tell with Hurley."
He produced and examined his pocket watch.
"He's only a quarter of an hour late. I shouldn't worry."
"It's flying away," said Galley.
The large airship was disappearing into the glowing darkness. Only the lights were visible now, bright pinpoints growing ever smaller. Bagwalter smiled at the boy, then turned to Paul.
"The little fellow tells me you rescued him from a place called the 8 Squares or something. Was that back on Earth?"
"I don't know. I told you, my memory is bad."
"The boy says it's just down the Great Canal. But I haven't heard of any such place here, and I've done a lot of traveling."
His voice was light, but the shrewd eyes were again watching Paul closely.
"He also said something about the Black Ocean, and I can promise you there's nothing like that here."
"I don't know." Paul felt his voice rising, but could not make it sound normal. Galley turned from the balcony railing to look at him, eyes wide.
"I just don't remember anything."
Bagwalter removed his cigar and stared at the smoldering tip, then lifted his eyes to Paul's once more.
"No need to get worked up, old man. I'm being a bit of a bore, I know. It's just that there were some rather odd fellows asking questions at the club a few days ago." "Look out below!"
Something whizzed between them and hit the balcony floor with a loud slap. It was a rope ladder, and it seemed to have dropped onto them from nowhere. Stunned, Paul looked up. A shape hovered overhead, like a dark cloud in the otherwise clear sky. A head poked out, peering down at them.
"Hope I didn't hit anyone. Damnably hard to keep this thing steady."
"It's Mr. Brummond," said Galley, delighted. "And he has a flying ship, too."
"Climb up," shouted Brummond. "Hurry, no time to waste."
Galley went up the ladder, shinnying as quickly as a spider. Paul hesitated, still not quite sure what was happening.
"Go on," said the professor kindly. "It does no good. Once Hurley's got a bee in his bonnet, there's no stopping him."
Paul grabbed the swaying ladder and began to climb. Halfway to the waiting airship, he paused, beset by a kind of spiritual vertigo. There was something tragically familiar in this situation, leaving one barely understood place to scramble toward another even less comprehensible refuge.
"Would you mind moving on?" Bagwalter said gently from below. "I'm not getting any younger, and I'd just as soon be off this ladder as quickly as possible."
Paul shook his head and resumed his climb. Brummond was waiting at the top, and pulled him over the railing with a single tug.
"What do you think of this little beauty, eh, Jonas?" he asked. "I told you there were a few favors I could call in. Let me show you around. She's a lovely piece of work, fast as a bird, quiet as grass growing. She'll do the job for us, you'll see."
"What job?" Paul was getting tired of asking questions.
"What job?"
Brummond seemed dumbfounded.
"Why, we're going to rescue your fiancée.
At dawn she goes to a special cell underneath the Sumbar's palace, and then it'll be too late. So we're taking her out tonight. Only a dozen guards, and we probably won't have to kill more than half of them."
Before Paul could do more than open his mouth and close it again, Brummond had sprung away to the airship's oddly shaped, ornately carved wheel. He pulled on it, and the ship rose so swiftly that Paul almost fell from his seat. The city dwindled below them.
"For the honor of your lady, Jonas!" Brummond shouted. His golden hair fluttered in the strong wind of their ascent. His grin was a glinting spot in the gloom.
"For the honor of our dear old Earth!"
With mounting discomfort, Paul realized that they were in the hands of a madman. Chapter 25. Hunger. Netfeed News. DA cries foul as snipe case dropped. Visual: Osinuelo holding press conference. VO: Dallas County District Attorney Carmen Osinuelo said that the defection and disappearance of witnesses from her landmark murder prosecution is the clearest example of subversion of justice since the Crack Baron trial. Visual: defendants at arraignment. The prosecution of 6 men, including 2 ex-police officers, for the murder of hundreds of street children, often called snipes, excited tremendous controversy because of the allegations that local merchants hired the men as a death squad to keep the upscale areas of Dallas-Fort Worth free of street children. Visual: children panhandling in Marsalis Park. Prosecutions for snipe hunting in other American cities have also had trouble obtaining convictions. Osinuelo: they have intimidated, kidnapped, or killed our witnesses, often with help from elements inside the police department. They are murdering children on the streets of America, and they're getting away with it. It's as simple as that. Good heavens, Papa, will you quit complaining?
I'm not complaining, girl. I'm just asking.
Over and over again. Rainey took a breath, then bent to try to pull the strap tight on the suitcase again. Few of their possessions had survived the fire, and the confusion of recent events had left Rainey no time for shopping. But they still seemed to have more things than they did storage. We're not safe here in this shelter. Anyone can find us. I've told you 100 times, Papa, we're in danger.
That's the damned silliest thing I ever heard.
He crossed his arms over his chest and shook his head as if to banish the whole concept into the oblivion it deserved. Rainey fought a powerful urge to give up, to stop fighting. Maybe she should just sit down beside her father and join him in wishing the real world away. There was a freedom in being obstinate, the freedom of ignoring unpleasant truths. But someone finally had to acknowledge those truths, and that someone was usually her. She sighed. Get up, you old troublemaker. Jeremiah is going to be here any moment.
I'm not going nowhere with no girly man.
Oh, for God's sake. She bent over, pulled the strap tight across the straining suitcase, and secured it on the magnetic tab. If you say one stupid thing to Jeremiah, just one stupid thing, I'm going to leave you and your bloody suitcase by the side of the road.
What kind of way is that to talk to your father?
He glowered at her from under his brows.
That man attacked me. He tried to strangle my throat.
He came looking for me in the middle of the night, and you two had a fight. You were the one who went and got a knife.
That's right.
Long Joseph's face brightened.
Oh, that's right. And I was going to cut him up for damn good, too. Teach him to come sneaking round my place.
Rainey sighed again. Just remember, he's doing us a big favor. I'm on half pay while I'm suspended, Papa, remember? So we're lucky to find somewhere to go at all.
There isn't supposed to be anyone living in that house until they sell it. Do you understand that? Jeremiah could get in trouble, but he wants to help me track down the people who did this to Susan, so he's helping us.
Okay, okay.
Long Joseph waved his hand, indicating that, as usual, she was underestimating his social graces.
But if he comes sneaking in my room at night and try to get mannish with me, I knock off his head.
It's all new. Jeremiah pointed to the mesh fence that now surrounded the house. The doctor's nephew decided to improve the security. He thinks it will make it easier to sell the place.
His pursed lips made it clear what he thought of these absentee landlords.
So you should be safe. Very high-tech thing, this security system. Top of the line.
Reaney privately had doubts that the kind of people they seemed to be up against would have any problems getting through even top-of-the-line domestic security. But she kept them to herself. It was certainly an improvement over the shelter.
Thank you, Jeremiah. I can't tell you how grateful we are. We really had no friends or family to go to. Papa's older sister died 2 years ago, and his other sister lives in England.
Wouldn't give you a stick to scratch your back, that one,
grumbled Long Joseph.
I wouldn't take nothing from her anyway.
The security gate hissed shut behind the car as they entered the semicircular drive. Reenie's father looked up at the house with sullen amazement.
God almighty, look at that. That's not a house, it's a hotel. Only white people have a house like that. You have to stand on the back of the black man to own a place so big.
Jeremiah hit the brakes, skidding more than a few inches along the gravel drive. He turned in the seat and stared back at Long Joseph, his long features pinched in a scowl.
You are talking like an idiot, man. You don't know anything about it.
I know an Afrikaner mansion when I see one. Dr. Von Blake never did anything but good for anyone.
Tears were welling in Jeremiah Dacko's eyes.
If you're going to say things like that, you can find somewhere else to stay.
Reenie winced, embarrassed and angry.
Papa, he's right. You're talking like an idiot. You didn't know Susan, and you don't know anything about her. We're coming to her house because she was my friend, and because Jeremiah is doing us a kindness.
Long Joseph raised his hands in martyred innocence.
My God, you people get touchy. I didn't say nothing against your doctor lady. I just said that's a white people's house. You a black man. Don't tell me you think white people have to work hard as a black man.
Jeremiah stared at him for a moment, then swung around again and inched the car forward to the front of the stoop. I'll get your bags out of the boot, he said. Reenie glared at her father for a moment, then got out to help. Jeremiah took them upstairs, showed them to a pair of bedrooms, and pointed out the bathroom. Reenie thought that her room, its walls papered in a faded design of cavorting rag dolls, must have been intended for a child, although the Von Blakes had never had one. She had never thought much about Susan's childlessness, but now she wondered if it had been a greater sorrow than the doctor had let on. She poked her head into her father's room. He was sitting on the bed, examining the antique furniture with suspicion.
Maybe you should lie down and have a nap, Papa.
She deliberately made it more of an order than a request.
I'll make some lunch. I'll call you when it's ready.
I don't know if I can get comfortable. Big old empty house like this. I can try, I guess.
You do that.
She shut the door and stood for a moment, letting her irritation subside. She let her gaze slide along the walls, the wide, high-ceilinged hall.
Stephen would love this,
she thought. The thought of him bouncing excitedly down the hallway, exploring this new place, suddenly made her almost dizzy with loss. She swayed, her eyes stinging with tears, and had to clutch the banister. Minutes passed before she felt composed enough to descend to the kitchen and apologize for her father's behavior. Jeremiah, who was polishing an already gleaming pan, waved her explanations away.
I understand. He's just like my father. That man never had a good thing to say about anyone.
He's not that bad,
Reenie said, wondering if that were in fact true.
He's just had a hard time of it since my mother died.
Dacko nodded, but did not seem convinced. I'm picking up your friend later tonight. I'll be happy to make dinner for you all.
Thank you, Jeremiah, but you don't need to do that.
She hesitated, wondering at the look of disappointment on his face. Perhaps he, too, was lonely. She knew of no other people in his life besides Susan Von Blake and his mother, and Susan was gone.
You've done us so many favors. I feel like I should cook for you tonight.
You're going to mess around in my kitchen? He asked sourly, only half joking.
With your permission, and with any advice you want to give, gladly taken.
We'll see.
It was a long walk between the kitchen and the living room, and Rini did not know where the light switches were. She made her way with great care down halls lit only by the thin orange light leaking in through the high windows from outside, trying to keep the ceramic lid on the casserole dish, despite hands made clumsy by potholders. The darkness seemed a tangible, powerful thing, an old thing, the security lights an inadequate human response. She swore as she banged her knee against an almost invisible table, but the reassuring noise of the others came drifting down the hallway. There was always something on the other end of darkness, wasn't there? Jeremiah and her father were making brittle conversation about the rich neighborhood of Kloof that surrounded them. Chabu, who had arrived with all of his worldly possessions in one small, cheap suitcase, looked up from his study of Susan's cave-painting photograph.
Rini, I heard you strike against something. Are you hurt?
She shook her head.
Just a bump. I hope you all have your appetites.
Did you find what you needed in the kitchen?
Jeremiah cocked an eyebrow.
Break anything?
Rini laughed.
Nothing but my pride. I've never seen so many cooking things in my life. I feel inadequate. I only used one dish and a couple of pans.
Don't talk yourself down, girl, said her father sternly. You are a real good cook.
I used to think so until I saw Jeremiah's kitchen. Making my little chicken casserole there was kind of like hiking into the middle of the Kalahari just to dry your clothes.
Chabu laughed at this, a delighted gurgle that even made Jeremiah grin.
Ah, well, she said. Everybody, hand me your plates.
Jeremiah and Rini were finishing the bottle of wine. Her father and Chabu had been sampling beers out of the cold pantry, although Long Joseph seemed to be getting a disproportionate share. Jeremiah had built a fire in the wide stone fireplace, and they had turned most of the other lights out, so that the light in the wide living room wavered and danced. But for the murmuring of the fire, the last minute had passed in silence. Rini sighed.
This has been such a nice evening. It would be so easy to forget all the things that have happened and just relax. Let go.
You see, girl, that's your problem, her father said. Relax. Yes, that's exactly what you must do. You always worrying, worrying.
Surprisingly, he turned to Jeremiah as though for support.
She work herself too hard.
It's not that easy, Papa. Remember, we're not here because we want to be. Somebody burned down our flat block. Some other people attacked Susan. No, let's be honest. They murdered her.
She cut a quick glance toward Jeremiah, who was staring at the fire, his long face somber.
We know a little about the people who seem to be responsible, but we can't get to them. Not in real life, because they're too rich and too powerful, and probably not by stealth either. Even if Mr. Singh, that's the old man, Papa, the programmer, knows what he's talking about, and we need to investigate this big network they've built, I don't see where I fit in anyway. I don't have the equipment to stay online long enough to get through the kind of security they must have for this other land.
She shrugged.
I'm feeling pretty hopeless about where to go from here.
Did they smash up everything of the doctors you could use?
Jeremiah asked.
I'm still not sure I understand everything you've told me. But I know that Dr. Von Blake would say you were welcome to anything that would help you.
Rini smiled sadly.
You saw what they did to her lab. Those bastards made sure there wouldn't be anything left anyone could use.
Her father snorted angrily.
That is the way. That is always the way. We throw the Afrikaner bastards out of the government and the black man still can't get no justice. Nobody will help my boy. My...
Stephen...
His voice abruptly cracked, and he brought one of his large, calloused hands to his face before turning away from the fire.
If anyone can find a way to help him, then your daughter can,
Chabu said firmly.
She has a strong spirit, Mr. Sulaweo.
Rini was surprised by the certainty of his words, but the small man would not meet her gaze. Her father made no reply. Jeremiah opened a second bottle of wine, and the talk slowly and somewhat awkwardly turned to other things. Then Long Joseph began quietly to sing. Rini was at first only conscious of it as a low tone on the edge of her attention, but gradually it became louder.
Imiti goba kala iti iti kunyakazu malamvu kanje, 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 kanje.
It was an old Zulu nursery song, something Long Joseph had learned from his grandmother, a lilting, repetitive melody as gentle as the wind it described. Rini had heard it before, but not for a long time. All the trees are bending, this way, now that way. All the leaves are shaking, this way and that, this way and that. A memory from her childhood surged up, from a time before Stephen had been born, when she and her mother and father had taken the bus to visit her aunt in Ladysmith. She had felt sick to her stomach, and had huddled against her mother while her father had sung to her, and not just the Kanja Kanja song. She remembered pretending to be sick even after she felt better just to keep him singing. Long Joseph was swaying gently from side to side as his fingers tapped out a spidery rhythm against his thighs.
Zipumula kanjanina, izinyone sile keni.
See them resting on this sunny day, those lovely birds in their happy homes. From the corner of her eye, Rini saw something moving. Khabu had begun to dance before the fire, bending and straightening in time to Long Joseph's song, his arms held out, stiff and angled, then brought back to his sides. The dance had a curious rhythm that was at once strange and soothing.
Imiti goba kale iti iti, kunyakazu malamvu kanje, 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 kanje.
Children, children. Children come home, children, children, children come home, children, children, children come home. The song went on for a long time. At last her father trailed off, then looked around the firelit room, shaking his head as though he surfaced from a waking dream.
That was very, very nice, Papa.
She spoke slowly, fighting the wine and dinner thickness in her head. She didn't want to say the wrong thing.
It's good to hear you sing. I haven't heard you do that in a long time.
He shrugged, a little embarrassed, then laughed sharply.
Well, this man here has brought us to this big house, and my daughter cooked the supper. I figured it was my turn to pay for my keep.
Jeremiah, who had turned from the fire to listen, nodded soberly, as though approving the transaction.
It reminded me of that time we went to Aunt Tamar's. Do you remember?
He grunted.
Woman had a face like a bad road. Your mama got all the looks in that family.
He stood.
Going to get another beer.
And your dancing was wonderful as well,
Rini told Khabu. She wanted to ask a question, but hesitated, afraid she might sound patronizing.
God,
she thought,
I have to be an anthropologist just to talk to my father and my friend. No, that's not true.
Khabu is a lot harder to insult.
Was that a particular dance?
She finally asked.
I mean, does it have a name, or were you just dancing?
The small man smiled, his eyes crinkling almost shut. I danced some of the steps of the Dance of the Greater Hunger. Long Joseph returned with two bottles and offered the second one to Khabu, who shook his head. Long Joseph sat down, a bottle in each hand, satisfied with the way his good manners had been rewarded. The small man stood up and walked to the photograph on the wall, and traced one of the bright painted figures with his finger. Then turned.
We have two hunger dances. One is the dance of the little hunger. That is the hunger of the body, and we dance it to ask for patience when our stomachs are empty. But when we are full, we do not need that dance. In fact, it would be discourteous after such good food as we had tonight.
He smiled at Rini.
But there is a hunger that is not solved by filling your belly. Not the meat of the fattest eland, not the juiciest ant eggs can cure it.
Ant eggs? Said Long Joseph in exaggerated tones of outrage. You eat eggs from a bug?
I have eaten them many times.
Khabu wore a slight smile.
They are soft and sweet.
Don't even say it.
Long Joseph scowled.
Make me sick just to think about it.
Jeremiah stood and stretched. But it's not crazy to eat bird eggs?
Fish eggs? Speak for yourself. I don't eat no fish eggs. As for bird eggs, just from chickens, and that is a natural thing.
When you live in the desert, you cannot avoid anything that can be safely eaten, Mr. Sulawayo.
Khabu's sly smile grew. But there are some things we like better than others, of course. And ant eggs are one of our favorites.
Papa's just a snob, Rini explained, and for all the wrong reasons. Tell me more about the dance, please. About the greater hunger.
Call me what you want, girl, her father said with an air of magisterial finality. Just don't put none of them on my plate.
All people know the greater hunger. Khabu pointed to the figures in the rock painting. Not only the people dancing here, but the person who painted the dancers, and all who have looked at the painting. It is the hunger for warmth, for family, for connection to the stars and the earth and other living things.
For love? Rini asked.
Yes, I suppose that could be true. Khabu was thoughtful. My people would not say it that way, but if you use the word to mean the thing that makes us glad of other people, which makes being together better than being alone, then yes, it is a hunger for the part of a person which cannot be filled by meat or drink.
Rini wanted to ask him why he had chosen that dance to perform, but felt it might be rude. Despite his robustness of body and spirit, there was something about the small man that made Rini feel clumsily protective.
It was a very nice dance, she said at last. A fine thing.
Thank you. It is good to dance among friends. A not uncomfortable silence settled over the room.
Rini decided it would be all right if she left the dishes until the next day, and got up to go to bed.
Thank you, Jeremiah, for taking us in.
Jeremiah Dako nodded, not looking up.
It's fine. You are welcome.
And Papa, thank you for the song.
He looked up at her, a strange, half-yearning look on his face, then laughed.
I'm just trying to pull my weight, girl.
She floated in and out of a half-doze, fretful and restless, knowing that there were too many problems without solutions to waste precious rest, but unable to do anything about it. Sleep and its welcome oblivion stayed exasperatingly beyond reach. At last she surrendered and sat up. She switched on the lights, then switched them off again, preferring darkness. Something that Khabu had said kept coming back to her, running through her disordered thoughts like the chorus of a popular song. The thing that makes us glad of other people, which makes being together better than being alone. But what could she and a few others hope to do in a situation like this? And why did it have to be her in the first place? Why didn't anyone else ever take responsibility? She thought of her father, just two doors away, and only the pleasant evening they had just spent allowed her to fight down a hot surge of resentment. No matter how hard she had been working and how little sleep she got tonight, he would be quick to complain if there was no breakfast waiting for him when he got up. He was used to being waited on. That was her mother's fault. Collaborating with some old-fashioned idea of the role of the African male. It must have been like that in the old days. The men sitting around the fire bragging about some gazelle they'd speared 3 weeks ago, while the women gathered food, made clothes, cooked, took care of the children. Yes, and took care of the men, who were children themselves, really, with their feelings so easily hurt if they weren't the center of the universe. She was full of anger, she realized. Anger at her father, and at Stephen for running away from her, although it felt terrible to be angry at him. But she was furious that he should go away, that he should lie in that hospital, silent and unresponsive, rejecting all her love, all her pain. If her mother hadn't died, would things have been different? Rini tried to imagine a life in which there had been someone else to shoulder the burden, but couldn't quite make the thought feel real. A normal adolescence? Or at least what would be normal in other places? Nothing to think about except studies and friends? A summer job if she wanted one, instead of a full-time job on top of her schoolwork? But it was a purely intellectual exercise, trying to imagine such a life, because the person who had grown up that way, who had spent the last 10 years in that life, wouldn't be her. Another Rini, one from beyond Alice's looking-glass. Her mother Miriam, long-limbed and fragile. She shouldn't have gone away. If she had never gone to the department store, everything would be better today. Just her wide smile, which used to blaze suddenly and surprisingly across her dark face, like a hand open to reveal a splendid gift, would have made Rini feel less alone. But Mama and her smile were only memories now, getting fainter every year. Better than being alone, Khabu had said, But wasn't that part of her problem? That she was never alone? That instead the people around were always expecting her to do something they could not do themselves? She herself didn't ask for things, though. It was easier just to be strong. In fact, it helped her stay strong. To admit she needed help might lead to losing her ability to cope.
But I do need help. I can't manage this by myself. I've run out of ideas. I am doing my best to find a solution, Rini.
Martine did not sound very hopeful.
The kind of equipment Singh was talking about costs very much money. I would lend you my own money, but it would not be enough nearly for what you need. I live a very simple life. Everything has gone into my own equipment.
Rini stared at the blank screen, wishing that she at least had Martine's Mona Lisa sim to look at. Human beings were hardwired to look at faces for information, for clues, just for the confirmation that another human was out there. Rini was quite accustomed to malfunctioning video on public uplinks, but at least when the screen was out of order, you were usually talking to someone whose features you already knew. She was touched by Martine's generosity, but it was still hard to feel the connection. Who was this woman? What was she hiding from? And, strangest of all, in a woman who worshipped privacy, why had she become so involved with this otherland madness?
I know it won't be easy, Martine, and I do appreciate your help. I just can't let Stephen go without a fight. I have to find out what happened. Find out who did this and why. And how are you, really?
Martine asked suddenly.
What? Oh, fine. Confused. Tired. But in yourself, how are you?
Rini abruptly saw the blankness of the screen as something else, the dark window of the confessional. She was tempted to tell the Frenchwoman everything, her obsessive fears about Stephen, her ridiculous mothering relationship with her own father, her actual terror of the forces they seemed to have engaged. All these things pressed down on her like a collapsing roof, and it would be good to have someone to complain to. There were moments when she felt the other woman, despite the self-created mystery surrounding her, could be a real friend. But Rini was not ready to trust that deeply, however much she might already have put her life in Martine's hands. There was a fine line between ordinary desperation and the complete loss of self-control.
I'm fine. Like I said, tired. Call me if you find out anything, or if you hear from our friend the anchorite. Very well. Good night, Rini. Thanks again.
She lay back again, feeling that she had at least done something. When she checked her account at the Poly in the morning, there were several messages relating to her suspension, a warning about cessation of mail privileges, a date for a preliminary hearing, a request for various system codes and files to be handed over, and one flagged personal. Rini, give me a call, please. Delray's face had been freshly shaved when he left the message, as though he were on his way to an important meeting. His beard grew faster than that of any other man she'd ever met. I'm worried about you. She had to fight the reflexive little kick in her stomach. What did worried mean, anyway? No more than what you'd say to any old friend who'd lost her job. He had a wife now. What was her name? Blossom? Daisy? Something stupid like that. Why should she care, anyway? She'd dealt with her feelings for Delray a long time ago. She didn't need him back in her life. Besides, with all the other things crowding for attention, where would she put him? She had a brief vision of a Delray shelf in the closet of her new ragdoll bedroom, and let herself laugh, just to feel and hear it. Rini lit another cigarette, took a sip from her glass of wine, an afternoon luxury available to the recently unemployed, and stared out past the security fence at the surrounding hills of Kloof. Should she call him back? He hadn't delivered anything to speak of so far, and his message didn't sound like he was promising new information. On the other hand, he might know something about this otherland place, and, more importantly, somewhere she could get access to professional VR equipment. She had to do something soon. If she were forced to give up, there would be nothing at all to tell the board of the Poly, except crazy-sounding allegations. Not to mention the fact that Singh, an old man seemingly marked for elimination, would be going it alone. And Stephen. To give up now would also be to give up on Stephen, to leave him forever sleeping, like some princess in a fairy tale, but with no hope of any prince making his way through the thorns to deliver the life-giving kiss. Rini put down the wine, which suddenly made her stomach feel sour. The whole mess seemed hopeless. She stubbed out her cigarette and then, since she had decided to call Delray back, lit another one. At the last moment, as her pad connected to the UNCOM main number, she heeded a cautionary thought and turned off her visuals. His assistant had only just gone off the line when Delray clicked on.
Reedy, I'm glad you called. Are you all right? There's no picture.
She could see him very well. He looked a little harried. I'm fine. I'm having a problem with my pad, that's all. He hesitated for a moment.
Oh. Well, never mind. Tell me where you are. I've been worrying about you.
Where I am?
You and your father left the shelter. I tried to call you at the Poly, but they said you're on a leave of absence.
Yes. Listen, I need to ask you about something. She paused on the brink of mentioning Otherland. How did you know we left the shelter?
I went there. I was worried about you.
She fought against the stupid schoolgirl flutter. Something about the conversation was bothering her. Delray, are you telling me the truth? You came all the way across town to look for us at the shelter, just because I was on leave of absence?
You didn't return my call.
It was a simple enough answer. But he looked tense and unhappy.
Just tell me where you are, Reenie. Maybe I can be of some help. I have friends. Maybe I can find you somewhere safer to stay.
We're safe, Delray. No need for you to put yourself to trouble.
Damn it, Reenie, this isn't a joke.
There was an edge beyond anger to his voice.
Just tell me where you are. Tell me right now. I don't believe that pad of yours is broken either.
Reenie took a breath, startled. She ran her fingers across the touchscreen. The security gear Martine had sent her flashed its readings across Delray's face. One set of characters shone brighter than the others, blinking road hazard yellow.
You bastard!
She breathed.
You're trying to trace my call.
What? What are you talking about?
But his expression suddenly twisted with shame.
Reenie, you are acting very strangely. Why won't you let me help you?
His face abruptly vanished as she cut off contact. Reenie stubbed out her cigarette with shaking fingers and stared unhappily at the cable running out of her pad, through the window and into the house jack. Her heart was beating very swiftly.
Delray sold me out.
The thought was almost surreal. That anyone could want her whereabouts enough to bend a government official was bizarre enough, but that Delray Chiume would do that to her. Their parting had been difficult, but never vindictive.
What did they do to him? Threaten him?
He had seemed frightened. She picked up her glass of wine and drained it. If she hadn't gone completely mad, if what she thought had just happened had really happened, then even Susan's security-fenced suburban respectable house was no refuge. Even if Delray's trace had failed, how long would it take before the people looking for them made their way down the short list of Reenie's acquaintances and paid another visit? Reenie unplugged her pad. Then, as if to hide her tracks, she snatched up ashtray and wine glass before hurrying inside. The back of her neck was prickling, and her heart had not slowed since she disconnected from Delray. It was, she realized, the ancient fear of a hunted animal. Chapter 26 Hunters and Prey. Netfeed Music. Horrible animals bring back classic sound. Visual clip from One Way for You to Be. V.O. Saskia and Martinos Benchlow, founding members of My Family and other horrible, horrible animals, say they are taking their one-time diamond-selling flurry group in a new and classical direction. Visual, Benchlow's at home with guns and peacocks. S. Benchlow.
We're going for the classic guitar sound of the 20th century. People who say it's just a gimmick.
M. Benchlow. They gracelessly squat. S. Benchlow.
Gracelessly? They're utterly cheesy. We're bringing something back, follow? But we're making it our own. Segovia, Hendrix, Roy Clark, that far classic sound.
I think I better go now,
she said. She didn't want to look at him because it made her feel funny.
But you just arrived. Ah, but of course. You're still grounded, aren't you? So you can't take too long returning from school.
He frowned a little. He looked sad.
Is it also because you're afraid I'm going to ask you to do something bad?
Christabel didn't say anything. Then she nodded her head. Mr. Sellers smiled, but he still looked sad.
You know I'd never do anything to hurt you, little Christabel, but I am going to ask you to do some things, and I want you to keep them secret.
He leaned forward, his funny, melted face very close to hers.
Listen to me. I'm running out of time, Christabel. I'm ashamed at having to ask you to break your parents' rules, but I'm truly desperate.
She wasn't quite sure what desperate meant, but she thought it meant in a hurry. Mr. Sellers had sent her a secret message on her desk screen at school asking her to come over today. Christabel had been so surprised to see it where her subtraction problems had been a second before that she almost hadn't noticed that her teacher was coming over. She had just managed to turn it off before Miss Carmen reached her, then had to sit quietly while her teacher scolded her for not working.
"If you don't want to do them," the old man continued, "then you don't have to. I'll still be your friend, I promise. But even if you won't do these things for me, please, please don't tell anyone I asked you. That's very important."
She stared. She had never heard Mr. Sellers talk like that. He sounded scared and worried, like her mother when Christabel fell down the front steps in their old house. She looked at his yellowy eyes, trying to understand.
"What do you want me to do?"
"I'll tell you. It's just three things. Like in a fairy tale, Christabel. Three tasks that only you can do. But first, I want to show you something."
Mr. Sellers turned in his chair and reached for the table. He had to push the thick leaves of one of his plants out of the way so he could find what he was looking for. He held it out to her.
"Now, what's that?"
"Soap."
She wondered if he was going to eat some. She'd already seen him do that.
"Ah, yes. In fact, it's one of the bars that you brought me. But it's more than that. Here, see this?"
He tilted the bar and pointed to a hole in one end.
"Now look."
He took the bar in both of his shaky hands and pulled it into two pieces, as though he were taking apart a sandwich. Nestled in the middle of the soap bar was a gray metal key.
"Pretty good trick, isn't it? I learned it from watching a prison movie on the net."
"How did it get inside the soap?"
she asked.
"And what's it for?"
"I split the soap in half and made a carving of what I wanted,"
Mr. Sellers explained.
"Then I made this hole, see, and put the two halves together, then poured in some hot metal. When it cooled, it made a key, and I'm about to tell you what it's for. That's one of the three tasks I have for you, Christabel. Well, are you ready to hear them?"
Christabel looked at the key lying on the soap like it was a mattress, like the key was sleeping until she woke it up, like Prince Charming. She nodded. She had to take her bike because it was a long way, also because she had heavy things to carry in the bike basket. She had waited until Saturday, when her mother and father went to the football game. Christabel had gone with them once, but she had asked so many questions about what the little tiny men down in the green field were doing that her daddy had decided she'd be more comfortable staying home. On football game days, Mommy and Daddy left her with Mrs. Gullison. On this Saturday, Christabel told Mrs. Gullison that she was supposed to go over and feed her friend's dog and take it for a walk. Mrs. Gullison, who was watching golf on television, told her to go ahead, but to come right back and not to look in any of her friend's parents' drawers. That was such a funny thing to say that Christabel had to stop herself from laughing. It was starting to get cold. She wrapped her scarf tight around her neck and tucked the fluttery ends into her coat so they wouldn't get caught in her bike wheels. That had happened once, and she had fallen off and skinned her knee. She pedaled hard down Stillwell, then turned across the little bridge and headed past the school. Mr. Diaz, the nice janitor, was dumping a bag of leaves into a trash bin, and she almost shouted and waved until she remembered that Mr. Sellers didn't want her to talk to anyone. She went down the streets just the way the old man had told her. Lots of streets. After a while, she came to a part of the base she'd never been to, a group of low huts made of wiggly, curvy metal surrounding a field of grass that hadn't been mowed in a long time. In a line behind the farthest row of huts
stood another group of boxy shapes that were a little like the huts, but lower and made of cement. They seemed to have been buried partway in the ground. Christabel couldn't figure out what they were for. If they were houses, they were very small ones. She was glad she didn't live in something like that. Starting from the side she'd come in, she counted just like Mr. Sellers had told her. 1, 2, 3, until she reached the 8th cement box. It had a door in it, and there was a padlock on the door just like he'd said there would be. Christabel looked around, worried that people might be watching her, just waiting for her to do something bad before they came running out at her, like in a police show she'd seen the other night. But she couldn't see anyone at all. She took out the funny, rough key that Mr. Sellers had made in the soap bar and put it in the lock. At first, it didn't quite fit, but she jiggled it a few times, and it slipped all the way in. End of side 15. To continue, turn the cassette over. Side 16. City of Golden Shadow. Otherland, Volume 1. By Tad Williams. Continuing on page 494. She tried to turn it, but couldn't make it move. Then she remembered the little tube Mr. Sellers had given her. She took the key back out and squeezed some goo from the tube into the hole in the lock. She counted slowly to 5, then tried again. The lock snapped open. The sound and the sudden aliveness of it in her hand made Christabel jump. When no policemen with guns and armor ran out from behind the metal huts, she pulled the door open. Inside was a hole in the cement floor and a ladder leading down, just like Mr. Sellers had said. The ladder was rough beneath her fingers, and Christabel made a face, but she had promised, so she climbed down. Even though she had seen nothing down in the hole, she still didn't like going into it. Mr. Sellers had said there wouldn't be any snakes, but he might be wrong. Luckily, it was only a short ladder, and before she had a chance to get too scared, she was on the floor again. When she looked down beneath her foot, the little room underneath the ground was empty of everything, snakes included, except for the thing she was looking for, a square metal door set into the wall. Christabel squatted beside the door, which was wider than she was, and half as big as the entire wall. On one side of it was the bar of metal that Mr. Sellers had called the bolt. She tried to wiggle it, but it wouldn't move. She took out her tube and squeezed some more goo. She couldn't remember exactly where Mr. Sellers had said to put it, so she kept squeezing all over the bolt until the tube was empty. She counted 5 again, then tried to wiggle it once more. At first, it didn't seem like it was moving. After a while, she thought she felt it quiver just a little, but it was still stuck. She sat and thought for a while, then climbed back up the ladder. She peeked out the door to make sure there was still no one watching, then climbed out of the cement box. It only took her a few moments to find a big enough rock. Christabel only had to hit it a few times. Then the little sticking-out piece on the bolt suddenly tipped down, and she could slide the whole thing back and forth. She pulled it as far back in its slot as it would go, like Mr. Sellers had told her, then clambered back up the ladder toward the afternoon sunlight. Pleased with herself for being brave and for successfully doing the first thing the funny old man had asked, she stood beside her bike and stared at the cement box. It was locked again, and the key was back in her pocket. It was a secret thing that only she and Mr. Sellers knew about. It gave her a tickly, excited feeling. Now there were only 2 more jobs left to do. She put on her storybook sunglasses for a moment to read Mr. Sellers' list again. She looked at her Otter World watch. Pick-a-Pick, the Otter Prince, was holding the numbers 1400 between his paws, which meant she had 15 minutes to get to the next place. She checked the grocery bag in her bike basket to make sure the bolt cutters were still there, then climbed onto the seat and pedaled away. Except for the tip of his nose and the tops of his cheekbones, Yakubian's face had gone pale with fury, a full shade lighter than his normal olive complexion.
"Say that again, slowly, so I can tell your next of kin what you looked like just before I tore your face off and ruined any chance for an open casket funeral."
Young Tanabe showed him a cool smile. "I'll be happy to say it again, General. All non-telemorphics personnel going into the lab, all will be searched. Period. By orders of Mr. Wells. If you have a complaint, sir, you should take it up with Mr. Wells. But you aren't going into this lab complex any other way. Sorry, General.
And if I don't consent to a search, then you either wait here, or if you become too disruptive, we have you escorted out. Sir, with respect, I don't think you want to mess with our security people. Tanabe casually indicated two very large men standing beside the doorway, who were listening to the conversation with a certain professional interest. That part of their bulk was due to the rubberized electrocatalytic body armor under their casual suits did not lessen the effect. In fact, General, here at TMX, we've got at least a half dozen security men who are veterans of your command. You would recognize the quality of their work. Yakubian glowered, then seemed to make a visible effort to disengage.
I hope you enjoy this. Go ahead.
Tanabe summoned the guards with a flick of his head. While they made a quick and thorough investigation of the general's person, Wells' assistant stood back, arms folded. Enjoyment has nothing to do with it, sir. I have my job, just like your men have theirs.
Yeah, but I can have my men shot.
Tanabe smiled again. Maybe my boss will give you an unexpected Christmas present this year, General. One of the guards pulled Yakubian's gold cigar case from his pocket.
Not this, sir. Unless you want to wait half an hour while we have it and its contents checked out. My God! Is the crazy old bastard even afraid to have an unlit cigar in the same room with him?
Tanabe took the cigar case. Your choice, General. Yakubian shrugged.
Jesus! Okay, little man, you win. Take me in.
Wells waited with some amusement until Yakubian had finished swearing.
I'm sorry, Daniel. If I had known you'd be so upset, I would have come out and searched you myself.
Very funny. After all this bullshit, it had better be worth it.
The general's hand strayed to his pocket, but finding no cigar case, retreated like a hibernating animal wakened too early. His scowl deepened.
What could you possibly have ready after only a couple of weeks? I mean, come on, Bob. Even your brain boys can't be that quick.
Boys and girls, Daniel, don't be so antediluvian. And no, we haven't done it in 2 weeks, more like 2 years. But we've put in thousands of work hours altogether during these last 2 weeks to finish it.
Something chimed softly inside the wall. Wells touched the top of his desk, and a drawer slid open before him. He withdrew a dermal patch and placed it carefully in the crook of his elbow.
"Just my medication," he apologized. "So, if you've calmed down, I'll show you what we've come up with."
Yakubian stood. He was quieter now, but there was a tightness to his posture that had not been there before.
"This whole thing was your idea of a joke, wasn't it? Keeping me waiting, then that search thing you knew would piss me off."
Wells spread his hands. Despite the ropey muscles and prominent bones, they did not tremble.
"Daniel, that's a little wild."
Yakubian was across the office and into his host's body space in a moment. He pushed his face to within an inch of Wells' own, then reached down and lightly finger-touched Wells' hand as it trailed toward the desktop security alarm, arresting its progress.
"Just don't ever dick me around, Bob. Remember that. Our relationship goes back a long way. We've been friends, even. But you don't ever want to find out what kind of enemy I can be."
Yakubian stepped back, suddenly smiling, leaving Wells groping for the support of a chair arm.
"Now, let's go see this little toy of yours."
The general stood in the middle of the darkened room.
"Well, where is it?"
Wells gestured. The four wall screens blazed with light.
"This is a lab, Daniel. But it's not the Frankenstein kind. We work with information here. The toy, as you called it, isn't the kind of thing I can put on a table and point at."
"Then don't be so damn theatrical."
Wells shook his head with mock regret.
"My people have put a lot of time into something we can't show anyone outside the company. Surely you won't begrudge me a little bit of showmanship?"
He waved his hand, and all four screens darkened. A hologrammatic display of small white dots formed in mid-air in the center of the room. They seemed to move randomly, like fast-motion bacteria or superheated molecules.
"I'll feel more comfortable if I can give you the context, Daniel, So I'm going to explain a little bit of the history of this project. Feel free to stop me if I tell you too many things you already know. Yacoubian snorted.
Stop you? How? Your security boys took my gun away.
Wells favored him with a wintry smile. The problem seems straightforward on the surface. The Grail Project is, at bottom, a simulation environment, although wildly more ambitious than any other thus far. As part of the experimental procedure, a subject chosen by our chairman, we'll call the subject X, for convenience's sake, since we still haven't been told his real name, was placed into the simulation. Wells gestured. An image of a coffin-like metal cylinder festooned with cables appeared, momentarily displacing the dots.
It hasn't been easy getting any information about the subject, by the way. The old man is playing everything close to the vest, but apparently X was subjected to various conditioning techniques to alter or efface his memory before they delivered him to us.
Conditioning techniques!
Yacoubian's laugh was short and harsh.
And you civilians make jokes about military euphemisms. What did they do? Give him a bad haircut and an excessive shampoo? They pithed his mind, Wells. They goddamn well brainwashed him.
Whatever. In any case, about a month or so back, there was a disruption of the monitoring equipment and a triggering of the splitting sequence. We still haven't been able to say decisively whether this was accident or sabotage, and contact with X was lost. Contact with his mind, that is. His body is still here on the premises, of course, about 50 feet beneath where you're standing, to be precise. But that means his submersion in the simulation network is ongoing, and we have no idea where in the Matrix he is.
Okay, now you've finally gotten to something I don't know,
Yacoubian said.
Why can't we find him? How hard can it be?
Let me show you something. Wells gestured again. The glowing white dots reappeared, then froze into something resembling a three-dimensional star map. Wells pointed. One of them turned red and began to blink. The old line simulations were very simple. Everything was reactive. When the subject looked at something, or touched it, or moved in a direction, the simulation responded. The red dot began slowly to move. The white dots, clustered most nearly around it, resumed their earlier motion. But all the other dots remained frozen. Everything occurred in relation to the subject. When there was no subject, nothing happened. Even with a subject involved, nothing happened beyond the edge of that subject's perceived experience. But this kind of simulation, like the early experiments in artificial intelligence it resembled, made for a very poor version of what it tried to simulate. Real human beings don't think in a linear series of if-then statements, and real environments don't stop changing if there's no human observer. So, artificial intelligence experimentation shifted toward artificial life instead, around the end of the last century. People started to create environments that evolved. The artificial organisms in these new environments, although very simple at first, evolved as well. An A-life experiment continued all the time, with the various artificial organisms living, feeding, reproducing, dying, whether any scientist was watching them or not. And that's what the new generations of simulations do, too, at least the high-end ones. Wells' finger flicked again. The red dot disappeared, but all the white dots leaped into frenetic motion again, some moving slowly, others fast as bullets. Some traveled in groups. Other lone dots roved on what seemed purposeful paths. Whether there is a human participant or not, the various components of the simulation—artificial living things, artificial weather, even artificial entropy—continue. They interact. Combine and recombine, and through this interaction, their individual simplicity begins to approach, and perhaps in some situations, even surpass the complexity of real life. He chuckled. Or R.L., as we used to call it. Yacoubian watched the sparkle of apparently random movement in the middle of the room.
That still doesn't tell me why we can't find this ex-bastard.
Wells summoned the red dot again. He froze the throng of dots, then turned to the general. Eyes mild but intent.
Okay, Daniel. I'll show you the old-fashioned simulation first. The kind that only reacts to the human participant. Let me just hide the subject.
The red dot turned a steadily glowing white.
Now I'll turn the whole thing on.
The dots sprang to life again. Or at least a few of them did. A pulsing swarm that seemed to travel slowly through the mock constellation like a funnel cloud, while the dots on either side remained static.
Which one is the subject?
Yacoubian leaned forward.
Got to be one of those in the middle there. That one. No, that one.
The cloud froze, and a single dot turned red.
Close, Daniel. I'm sure you would have gotten it with just a little more observation. Now we'll try it with a simulation model that's more like the Grail Network.
The red dot turned white again. Then all the dots began to move at once.
I've lost it.
Exactly.
Wells pointed, and the hologram faded. The wall screens lit up in a muted gray, etched with an almost invisible shadow of the TMX logo.
When simulations behave as much like real life as ours do, there's no easy way to discern which seemingly living object is a human participant and which is just part of the pseudo-life.
Yacoubian looked around. Wells, anticipating, clapped his hands gently. Two chairs rose from recessed slots beneath the floor.
But it's our goddamn simulation network!
The general dropped heavily into one of the chairs.
Why don't we just turn it off? You can't tell me he'd still be running around in there somewhere if we jerked out the cord.
Telemorphix's founder sighed.
It's not that easy, Daniel. If we simply freeze all the simulations on the network, we don't change anything. X is going to look just like an artifact in whatever simulation he's in, and artifacts don't have individual histories that can be checked. They just exist. We don't have enough processors on this planet to keep records of everything that's happened in the Grail Project since we went gold with it. And as for actually pulling the plug, Christ, Daniel, do you realize how much time and money the people in the Brotherhood have put into growing these environments? Because that's what they are. Grown. Self-created by evolution. Just like a real environment. Trillions! They've spent trillions, and invested almost 2 decades' worth of high-speed processing as well. The complexity of this whole thing is almost incomprehensible. And you want to just pull the plug? That would be like going to the richest neighborhood in the world and saying, "There's a cockroach loose around here. Do you mind if we burn down all your houses to drive it out?" It's just not going to happen, Daniel.
The general patted his pocket again, then scowled.
But you've got a solution, huh?
I think so. We've built an agent.
He gestured, and the wall screens began to fill with text.
Agent? I thought there were already agents to do this kind of thing. King Tut, or God Almighty, or whatever he's calling himself these days, said he already had state-of-the-art agents involved.
Ah, but there's the rub, you see. Not that we know much about those, either. His people have pretty much controlled that part of the project, and up till now I've stayed out of their way. But chances are that any agents he has in there, whether human or artificial, are going about their search in the old-fashioned way.
Meaning?
Hunting for similarities. My people have found out what they could. It's hard to keep anything completely secret in a shared scientific environment, and as far as we can tell, the old man's team have been tracking X since he was put into the network, which means that they've developed something like a behavioral profile, a map of how X has acted in several different simulations. So whatever agents or tracking gear they're using now,
probably compare that map against the behavior profiles of all the units within the network.
Yeah? Sounds like the right way to go about it.
For a third time, Yakubian patted his pocket. It would be, on a less complex system. But as I've been trying to tell you for a long time, ours isn't like any other simulation network. For one thing, because there's no tracking of individual units, map comparisons have to be made one at a time, case by case. Wells frowned. You know, you really should try to stay abreast of all this, Daniel. It's just as important to you as to any of the rest of us.
Yeah? And how much do you know about my end of things, brain boy? How informed are you on the global security situation? Our use of military infrastructure?
Touché. Wells at last sat down. All right. Let me continue. The problem with trying to make a behavioral match in this old-fashioned way is not just the complexity of the network, either. More importantly, the behavioral signature of any free agent will change from one simulation to another. Not much, maybe, but it will still change. You see, almost all these simulations are designed to be immediately functional for a user. That is, if you don't choose characteristics for yourself before entering, the simulation will assign them to you based on its own logic. Therefore, if X is moving from simulation to simulation, he's probably being changed at least slightly each time by the simulations themselves. In this case, the brainwashing, as you so crudely but accurately put it, is working against us. If he has no memory, his sim is probably being shaped by the simulations, rather than the other way around. And there's one last problem. Any old-fashioned agents that can move freely through the network will probably have a certain amount of integrity to them. That is, they won't change much. They'll tend to be easy to spot after a while. And since they need a certain amount of time and proximity to the suspected unit before they can make a match and proceed to the capture, X may be able to stay ahead of them almost indefinitely.
Shit! So what have you got that's better?
We think we have the new state of the art. Wells quirked his lips. Am I going to be accused of being overly dramatic again? No? Then here. He snapped his fingers and a cable was extruded from the arm of each chair. Plug yourself in. The general pulled out the cable and slotted it into an implant behind his left ear. Wells did the same.
I don't see anything. Just a bunch of trees and a lake.
That tree there? That's our agent.
What the hell are you talking about? An agent that's a tree? Have you completely lost your mind?
Now see this scene? See the woman at the front table. That's our agent. Next one. And that's our agent. The soldier carrying the flamethrower. Yakubian squinted at nothing visible from the outside.
So the thing changes?
Blends into any environment. The reason I didn't bring you in and show you some model or drawing or something is because there isn't anything to show. It's the perfect mimic, and thus the perfect tracking device. It can fit into any environment.
So it's going to blend in. What good is that?
Wells sighed. Even if he escapes it once or twice, it still won't be recognized by X, because it will never have the same form or figure, and it will learn as it goes, find more sophisticated ways to adapt and gather information. But more importantly, it's going to sift data at a higher level than the old-style agents, because it's not looking to find matches for a single map. In fact, it's doing the opposite, looking for anomalies.
So if it finds an anomaly, boom, we got him.
I should digitize you and make you part of my new employee curriculum, explaining to the non-technical. No, Daniel, it's not that easy. Remember, we started this network with less than 100 different simulations, but there must be at least a few thousand by now. I mean, I've got about 40 or so myself. Add to that the fact that at any given time there must be more than 10,000 real live humans using the simulations. A lot of our junior members are paying for their place on the Grail Project waiting list by letting their friends and business associates rent time on the network. So with constant change in the simulations, living users who are almost impossible to distinguish from artifacts, and, well, suffice it to say, a few other bits of emergent weirdness that we're still studying, what I'm calling anomalies, are happening in the tens of millions. But still, our new agent will sift and track faster than anything else, and speed is important. Like it or not, we are in a bit of a race with our chairman, but this baby will be the one to find X, and anyone else we ever want to locate. That I promise. He chuckled. You know what we codenamed the agent? Nemesis.
The general thumbed the cable out of his neck.
I never thought much of those foreign cars.
He watched as Wells popped loose his own cable.
Oh, for Christ's sake, I'm joking, you pissant. I know about Greek mythology. So when are you going to launch your little monster? Going to break a bottle of champagne over the wall screen?
Wells looked a little put out.
I launched it already. Even as we speak, it's making its way through the system. Learning, changing, going about its business. Never has to be fed, never needs a day off. The perfect employee.
Yacoubian nodded and stood.
I'm in favor. Speaking of perfect employees, when you're done with your man Tanabe, let me know. I'm either going to hire him or kill him.
Doubt you'll get the chance for either, Daniel. TMX has even less turnover than the military. Our benefits package is very fine.
Well, I can dream. Which way out of here?
I'll show you.
As they walked down a deeply carpeted hallway, the general turned and gently took the founder of Telemorphics by the arm.
Bob, we never really went into the lab at all, did we? Not the super clean part where security matters. I mean, I didn't have to be searched just to go into that conference room, did I?
Wells took a moment to answer.
You're right, Daniel. I did it just to piss you off.
Yacoubian nodded, but did not look at Wells. His voice was very, very steady.
Thought so. One to you, Bob.
He had never much liked flying. He did it with some frequency, and was aware that even with the modern age's traffic-choked skies, it was perhaps the safest way to travel. But this did not soothe the more primitive part of his spirit, the part that did not trust any experience he could not control with his own hands and mind. That was the thing of it. He had no control. If lightning struck the Skywalker on takeoff or descent, storms of any kind were not a problem at the plane's cruising altitude of 105,000 feet, there was really nothing he could do about it. He could kill as many people as he wanted, disrupt the electronic equipment with the strange twist he had inherited from one of his long-dead parents, but that still would not bend an out-of-control suborbital Chinese-made passenger jet to his will. Dread was gnawing at this sour thought and others like it, because the descent into Cartagena was rough. The big plane had been bucking and slaloming for the last quarter of an hour. A tropical storm, the Qantas captain had informed them with studied ocker nonchalance, was kicking up a bit of a fuss in the whole Caribbean basin, and the ride down would be a bit bumpy. Still, he reminded them, they should all be sure to look at the lights of Bogota, which would be sliding past on the left side of the plane any moment now. As the captain finished his sightseeing suggestions and winked off the seat screen, the plane heaved again, a thrash like a wounded animal. Nervous laughter rose above the hum of the engines. Dredd lowered himself farther into his seat and clasped the armrests. He had turned off his inner music, since playing his soundtrack would only emphasize that he was helpless, that for the moment he wasn't writing the script for his own Netflix at all. In fact, there was really nothing he could do to make himself feel any better. He would just have to hang on and hope for the best. It was like working for that old bastard, really. Another roller coaster swoop. Dredd clenched his jaw, tasting bile at the back of his throat. To add insult to injury, the old man, the would-be god who was undoubtedly rich beyond Dredd's comprehension, still made his employee fly commercial.
¿Está usted enfermo, señor? Someone asked. He opened his eyes. A pretty young woman with a round face and golden hair was leaning over him, her face expressing professional but still genuine concern. Her name tag read Gloriana. Something about her was strangely familiar, but it wasn't her name. It wasn't the unpleasantly Spartan jumpsuit she wore either, a fashion for cabin assistants that he hoped would pass quickly. "I'm fine," he said. "Just not a very good flyer."
"Oh," she was a bit surprised. "You're an Aussie, too."
"Born and bred." With his unusual genetic heritage, he was frequently taken for Latin American or Central Asian. He smiled at her, still trying to figure out why her appearance plucked at his memory. The plane shuddered again.
"God, I hate this," he said, laughing. "I'm never happy until I've landed."
"We'll be down in just a few minutes."
She smiled and patted his hand.
"Never fear."
The way she said it, and the re-emergence of the smile, suddenly popped the memory loose. She looked like the young kindergarten teacher at his first school, one of the only people who had ever been kind to him. The realization brought with it a kind of sweet pain, an unfamiliar and somewhat disconcerting sensation.
"Thank you."
He put some energy into a return smile. He knew from experience that his smiles were impressive. One of the first things the old man had done was send him to the best cosmetic dentist in Sydney.
"It's nice of you to be concerned."
The captain announced final descent.
"It's my job, isn't it?"
She made a deliberately exaggerated cheerful face, and they shared a chuckle. Customs was easy, as always. Dredd knew better than to carry anything unusual, leaving even his own perfectly legal hardware at home. You could never tell when you might bump into a border agent who was a closet hobbyist and might recognize and remember serious top-of-the-line wear. That was what carefully nurtured local contacts were for, after all, to supply you the things you didn't want to bring in. As usual, Dredd carried nothing more controversial than a mid-level Critipong pad and a few suits in an Insulex garment bag. After a short cab ride, he caught the elevated train across the causeway to the Gethsemane section of the old town, which looked back across the bay from behind the murallas, the centuries-old military walls the Spanish had built to protect their port city. He checked into his hotel under the name Deeds, unfolded his garment bag and hung it in the closet, set his pad on the polished desk, then went back downstairs to run some errands. He returned to the hotel in less than an hour, put away what he had acquired, then went out again. It was a warm night. Dredd walked down the cobbled streets unnoticed by either tourists or locals. The smell of the Caribbean and heavy feel of the tropical air were not that different from home, although the humidity was more like Brisbane than Sydney. Still, he thought, it was strange to come so far and have only the after-effects of an 8-hour flight to prove you were somewhere different. He picked a public phone at random and gave it the number he'd memorized. When the call was answered, voice only, no picture, he reeled off another number and was immediately given an address. Then the other party hung up. The hover cab dropped him off in front of the club and grunted away, skirts fluttering over the uneven surface. A crowd of young people in scarlet Mahdi bands and imitation body armor, the Colombian version of goggle boys and goggle girls, stood in front waiting to be admitted. He had only been in line for a few moments when a street urchin tugged at his sleeve. Many of the visible areas of the child's skin had been burned red raw by the use of scavenged skin patches. The boy turned and walked off down the street, limping slightly. Dredd waited a few moments before following him. They were in the darkened stairwell of an old building near the waterfront when the urchin vanished, slipping away through some unseen exit so quickly and expertly that the man he had been guiding did not immediately notice his absence. Dredd, who had been alert since entering the building for the slight but worrisome possibility of an ambush, was impressed by the child's skill. The sisters chose their minions well, even at the lowest level. At the top of the stairs, a half-dozen old wooden doors ran down each side of the hallway, standing guard over a solitary and rather unfortunate-looking rubber plant. Dredd walked noiselessly along the hall, scanning each door in turn until he found one with a handpad. He touched it, and the door opened, revealing itself to be both thicker than its appearance suggested
and hung on strong hinges in a fibramic box frame. The room spanned the length of the entire floor. The other doors were false, at least on this side of the hallway. The exterior windows, however, had been left in place. From the doorway, Dredd had six separate views of the seaport and the choppy Caribbean. Except for these Monet-like ocean vistas, the room's white walls, black marble table, and Yi Xing tea service were an almost perfect copy of his simulated office. Dredd smiled at the sister's little joke. A light was blinking on the only object of modern furniture in the room, a huge, sleek desk. He sat down, quickly found the retracting panel that contained the connection hardware, and plugged himself in. The room stayed in place, but the Baena sisters abruptly appeared on the far side of the table, side by side, their sims as featureless as two parcels wrapped in brown paper. For a brief moment, Dredd was startled until he realized that he was in a simulation which duplicated the room even more exactly than the room mirrored his own online office. "Very nice," he said. "Thank you for preparing this welcome."
"Some people find their environment crucial to their ability to work," said one of the Baenas, her tone implying that neither she nor her sister were such people. "Our program is ambitious. You will need to be at your best. We await the second third of our payment," said the other lumpy shape.
"You received the coded list?" Both sisters nodded in synchrony. "Then I'll download one of the two keys now." He felt around on the unfamiliar desk for the touchscreen, then opened the account the old man had created and dispatched the sisters one of the pair of encryption keys necessary to access the list.
"You'll get the other when the operation launches," as we agreed.
When the Baenas, or their expert system, had examined the goods, they nodded again, this time indicating satisfaction.
"We have much work to do,"
one of them said.
"I've got time now. Although I have something I really must do before too late tonight. Tomorrow, I'm all yours."
There was a moment of silence from the twin shapes, as though they were considering this as a literal possibility.
"To begin with," said one, "the target has changed security companies since we last briefed you. The new company has come in and altered several aspects of the compound's defenses, not all of which we have discovered. We know little about the new company, whereas we had several informants at the previous firm."
"Which may be why they've changed their security people."
Dredd called up the report. The information hung in the air before him. He began to bring up the rest of his array. Charts, lists, topographical maps, blueprints. Color-coded and gleaming, they turned the virtual office into a neon fairyland.
"How does this change of security affect your program?"
"It means more danger to you and the rest of the ground team, of course,"
said one of the sister shapes.
"And it means we will undoubtedly have to kill more people than we planned."
"Ah,"
he smiled.
"What a shame."
Even a cursory discussion of the new twists in the operation took several hours. When he had terminated the contact and left his new office, he was feeling stretched thin by work and the flight in. He walked back along the waterfront, letting the soothing sound of the ocean wash over him. As he passed large and imposing office buildings, a small formation of camera drones, activated by motion or his body heat, came swarming out. They overflew him once, then retreated to the shadows, scanning him all the while. Tired and irritated, he resisted the impulse to lash out at this surveillance, to damage or confuse them. It would be a waste of time, as well as foolish. They were only doing their job, monitoring someone who was close to their building after hours. The pictures would be viewed briefly in the morning by a bored guard, then the information would be erased.
As long as he didn't do anything rash, that was. "Confident, cocky, lazy, dead," he reminded himself, walking on without a backward glance.
The old man would be proud of him. He walked into his room and undressed, then hung his suit in the closet. He examined his naked form in the mirror for a few moments, then sat on the bed and turned on the wall screen. He brought up his own inner music. A burst of deep sonic Mono Loco dance dirge, in honor of his visit to Columbia. He found something on the wall screen with abstract but fast-changing visuals, and turned up the sound in his head until he could feel the bass pulsing in his jawbone. He watched the images flicker by for a few moments, then checked himself in the mirror again. There was something predatory in his long, muscled limbs, in the flatness of his own expression, that excited him. He'd seen that face before. He'd seen that movie. He knew what was going to happen now. As he walked to the bathroom, he threw a few dissonant horn blasts into the music, sharp edges of sound that suggested mounting tension. He brought the volume down as he opened the door. Camera zooms in. Her wrists were still bound to the shower head with tape, but she was no longer standing upright. Instead, she hung with knees bent and her weight on her extended arms in a way that he knew must be painful. When she saw him, she screamed and began to struggle again, but the tape on her mouth reduced the cry to a muted bleat. "I followed you," he said as he sat down on the edge of the bathtub. In his head, with the music underneath it, his voice had a deep, leading man resonance. "I followed your cab until it dropped you at your hotel. After that, it wasn't very difficult to find your room, Gloriana." He reached out to touch her name tag, and she jerked away. He smiled, wondering if she noticed that it was the same smile he'd used on the plane. "Normally, I'd want a more extended hunt, a little more sport. I mean, that is what you're here for, isn't it? Soothing the cares of the weary business traveler. But taking you out of there and bringing you up here, all in your own suitcase, well, I'd say that was pretty good for spur of the moment, wouldn't you?" Her eyes widened and she tried to say something, but the tape choked it off. Writhing on the showerhead, she swayed from side to side. Her blonde hair, so immaculately styled 6 hours ago, hung in lank, sweaty curls. He reached out and plucked her name tag free. It was the electrostatic kind, with no interest in sharp bits, so he tossed it aside. "You know," he said, "I know your name, sweetness, but you never asked mine." He stood and walked out of the bathroom, slowing the music inside him until it was something like an underwater funeral march, deep and heavy and resonant. He came back in with the hardware store bag. "It's dread." He opened the bag and produced a pair of pliers and a file. "Now, let's get you out of that ugly uniform." Christabel was worried. It was taking her a long time to ride to the place Mr. Sellers had said. What if Mrs. Gullison went to her friend's house looking for her? What if her friend's parents were home? She would be in real trouble. And it would be even worse when Daddy found out. Thinking about how angry her father would be made her close her eyes. She accidentally rode down off the curb and almost fell when her bike thumped onto the road and her front wheel went all wobbly. She pedaled hard until the bike was going straight again. She had promised Mr. Sellers that she'd help him, so she had to do it. The place he'd told her to go was along the outside edge of the base, another part she'd never seen before. It was way behind the athletic field. She could see men in white shorts and shirts doing some exercises on the grass. Music and a voice she couldn't understand because it was too far away were coming from speakers on poles by the field. The place Mr. Sellers had sent her had lots of trees and bushes on this side of the fence, and trees and bushes on the other side of the far fence, but none in between. The empty space between the two fences looked like when she took her eraser and rubbed it across a drawing she'd done. Mr. Sellers had told her to pick a spot where there were some trees behind her, so no one would see what she was doing. After a little hunting, she found one. When she looked back, she couldn't see the field or any of the houses or other buildings, although she could still hear the music coming from the field. She took her school bag out of her bike basket, took the bolt cutters and put them on the ground, then took out the little scissor things and the roll of screen. She took the scissors and went to the fence, which was made of something almost like cloth, with little boxes along the top that made a quiet clicking noise. Beyond the outer fence, far away, smoke from campfires floated up into the air. Some people lived underneath the trees outside. She saw them when she and her parents drove off the base, and even more of them lived down in the valley near the freeway. They made their own homes, funny places built from old boxes and pieces of cloth, and her daddy said some of them even tried to sneak into the base by hiding in garbage trucks. She could see some of the box people through the fence, far away and tinier than the men on the exercise field behind her. But the fence was funny to look through. Everything on the other side was a little cloudy, like when you could write your name on the inside of the car window. She touched the scissors to the fence cloth, then remembered that Mr. Sellers had said not to cut it yet. She went back to the bike basket and got out her storybook sunglasses. "Christabel," the message in them said, "if you are at the fence, turn your sunglasses off and on 2 times fast." She thought about this for a moment to make sure she was going to do it right, then pushed the button on the side of her glasses 4 times. Off on, off on. When the pictures had come back inside them again, there was a new message. "Count to 10 and then cut. When you are at the second fence, turn the sunglasses off and on 2 more times. Christabel had gotten to 6 when the music from the field suddenly went quiet, and the boxes stopped clicking. She was frightened, but no one came or shouted at her, so she kneeled down and pushed the scissors into the fence. At first it was hard, but after the point suddenly went through, everything else was easy. She slid the scissors up as far above her head as she could reach, then picked up the big cutters and ran to the second fence. There was still no music, and the sound of her footsteps on the dirt sounded very loud. This fence was made all of diamond shapes of thick wire covered in plastic. She turned her glasses off and on 2 times. "Cut the second fence 1 wire at a time, then come back. When your watch says 14:38, come back right away, no matter what. Don't forget the little screen." Christabel squinted. Prince Pickapick was already holding 14:28 between his paws, so she knew that wasn't very much time. She put the cutters on one of the pieces of fence wire and squeezed them with both hands. She squeezed and squeezed until her arms really hurt, and at last the biting part of the clippers snapped together. She looked at her watch, and the numbers said 14:31. There were still a lot of wires left to cut to make a hole as big as Mr. Sellers said to make. She began to cut the second wire, but it seemed even stronger than the first, and she couldn't make the big cutters bite through. She began to cry. "What the hell you do, Enid? ¿Qué haces?" Christabel jumped and made a squeaking sound. Someone was watching her from a tree on the far side of the fence.
Nothing,
she said. The person jumped down from the tree branch. It was a boy, his hair cut funny, his face dark and dirty. He looked like he was a few grades older than her. 2 more faces poked out of the leaves along the branch where he had been, a little boy and girl even dirtier than he was. They stared at Christabel like monkeys with their big eyes.
"Don't look like nothing, Weenit," the older boy said. "Look like cutting that fence. Come."
It's a secret."
She stared at him, uncertain of whether to run. He was on the far side of the fence, so he couldn't hurt her, could he? She looked at her Otterworld watch. It read 14:33.
"Muchita loca. You never cut that. Too small, you. Throw those here."
He gestured at the bolt cutters. Christabel stared at him. He didn't have one of his front teeth, and he had funny pink patches on his brown arms.
"You can't steal them. Just throw them over."
She looked at him, then grabbed the cutters by both handles. She swung them, then threw them as high as she could. They clattered against the fence and almost hit her as they fell back down. The boy laughed.
"You too close, Weenit. Get back."
She tried again. This time the cutters skittered over the top, between the coils of sharp sticker wire, and fell down on the other side. The boy picked them up and looked at them.
"I cut for you, I keep these?"
She thought for a moment, then nodded, not sure if Mr. Sellers would be mad or not. The boy bent to the next wire up from the one she'd already cut and squeezed the cutters. It was hard for him, too, and he said some words she'd never heard, but after a little while the wire snapped. He moved on to the next. Christabel's watch read 14:37 as he finished.
"I have to go home," she said.
She turned around and ran across the bare ground toward the first fence.
"Hold on, Weenit,"
he called after her.
"Thought you running away from Mama Papa Army Base. What do you do this for?"
She ducked through the hole in the first fence and was just about to jump on her bicycle before she remembered. She turned back and unrolled the little screen Mr. Sellers had given her. "This kind of fence," he had said, "the first fence, it talked to itself, and so it needed this little piece of screen so it could talk across the places she'd cut." She didn't know what that meant, but she knew it was very important. She spread the piece of screen until it covered all the part that was cut. It stuck where she pressed it.
"Hey, Weenit, come back!"
the boy shouted. But Christabel was already throwing all of her things back in her school bag, and she didn't look back. As she jumped on her bike, the boxes on the fence started clicking again. A few seconds later, as she began to pedal toward home, she heard the music come back on again by the athletic field, strange and smeary in the distance. Chapter 27 Bride of the Morning Star. Netfeed News. Kreller declares bankruptcy again. Visual, Kreller on Tasmanian beach with Hagen. V.O. Colorful and controversial financier Uberto Kreller has declared bankruptcy for the second time in 10 years. Kreller, known as much for his famously stormy marriage to net star Vila Hagen and his month-long parties as his business interests, is reported to have lost 3.5 billion Swiss credits in the crash of his Black Shield technology empire. Visual. Black Shield employees leaving Madagascar factory. Black Shield, which was an early and heavily bankrolled entrant into nanotechnology, suffered huge losses when the financial community lost faith in the new industry after a series of disappointing technical failures.
"Martine, please, we really need this."
Rini was trying to keep her voice calm, but not succeeding.
"Forget the equipment. We have to find somewhere to hide. We have nowhere to go."
"I've never seen no craziness like this," her father said from the back seat. "Driving around and around."
The blank screen remained maddeningly silent for long moments as Jeremiah turned the car onto the motorway and headed back toward Midtown Durban again. The pad was plugged into Dr. Von Blake's skyphone, and the transmission was being scrambled. But although the Frenchwoman seemed content with the security of the line, Rini was on edge. The shock of Delray's betrayal had left her jumpy and unsettled.
"I am doing the best I can do,"
Martine said at last.
"That is why I am being quiet. I have several lines going. I have been doing some other checking as well. There is no police bulletin mentioning you, at least."
"That doesn't surprise me." Rini struggled for calm.
"I mean, I'm sure it's a lot more subtle, whatever they're up to. We haven't done anything, so they'll find some other excuse. One of Dr. Von Blake's neighbors will report people living in what's supposed to be an empty house. Then we'll be arrested for squatting or something. But it won't be anything we can fight. We'll just disappear into the system somewhere."
"Or it may be something more direct that does not use the law at all,"
Khabu added somberly.
"Do not forget what happened to your flat block."
"I wonder if Otasco and those Grail people had something to do with my suspension."
Only the confusion of fleeing Susan's house had kept her from thinking of it earlier. The world outside the car seemed full of terrible but unforeseeable dangers, as though some poisonous gas were replacing the atmosphere.
"Or am I becoming completely paranoid? Why would anyone go to so much trouble over people like us?"
"I think this is becoming a lot of foolishness," said her father. "We just move in, then we go running out the door again."
"With respect, Mr. Sulawayo, I think I must agree with Rini,"
Martine said.
"You are all in danger, and should not go back to the doctor's house or anywhere else you are known. Pour moi, I will keep trying to find some solution for these problems. I have a possibility that may solve both, but I am following a very faint trail that is 20 years old, and I am also trying not to make too much attention, if you understand. I will keep a line open for you. Call me if anything else happens."
She clicked off. They drove on along the motorway for some minutes in a tense silence. Jeremiah was the first to break it.
"That police car. I think it is following us."
Rini craned her head. The cruiser, with its protruding light bar and bulging armor and crash bumpers, looked like some kind of predatory insect.
"Remember, Martine said there's no general alert out for us. Just drive normally."
"They probably wondering what four Kaffir people doing in a big car like this," her father growled. "Afrikaner bastards."
The police car pulled out from behind them and into the next lane, then gradually accelerated until it was skimming along beside them. The officer turned to stare at them from behind mirrored goggles with the calm confidence of a larger and more powerful animal. She was black.
"Just keep driving, Jeremiah,"
Rini whispered.
"Don't look."
The police car paced them for almost a mile, then pulled ahead and darted down an off-ramp.
What is a black woman doing riding around in one of those?
Shut up, Papa. They were parked in the outermost marches of a vast parking lot outside a warehouse mall in Westville when the call came in. Long Joseph was sleeping in the back seat, his feet sticking out of the open car door, 6 inches of bare skin showing between pants cuff and socks. Rini was sitting on the hood with Khabu, drumming her fingers and smoking her 12th cigarette of the young day, when the buzz sent her scrambling to the ground. She snatched the pad from the car seat and saw that it was displaying Martine's code.
"Yes? Any news? Rini, you make me breathless."
"I hope so.
Are you still in Durban?"
"Close."
"Good. Could you please switch the frequency again?"
She pressed a button, and the doctor's Skyphone cycled through to another channel. Martine was already there, waiting. Rini was again impressed by the mystery woman's expertise.
"I am dizzy and tired, Rini. I have examined so much information that I will be dreaming about it for days, I think. But I have found, perhaps, a thing that may help some of your problems."
"Really? You found some equipment?"
"A place, also, I hope. I have come across a South African government program, a military project closed because of budget problems some years ago. It was called Wasp's Nest, and was an early experiment in unpiloted fighting aircraft. There is no official record of it, but it existed. I have found certain, how do you say, first-hand accounts of people who worked there, if that makes sense."
"No, it doesn't really. But I just need to know if the thing will do us any good. Is there some way we can get access to the actual machinery?"
"I hope so. The closing was temporary, but it never reopened. So it is possible that some of the equipment still remains on the site. But the records are very, what is the word, imprecise. You will have to investigate it for yourself."
Rini could hardly bear the slight stirring of hope.
"I'll take the directions. Jeremiah's not back yet. He's getting us some food."
She fumbled open the panel on the back of the pad.
"I'll just jack this thing into the car so you can download the map coordinates."
"No!" Martine was surprisingly sharp.
"That cannot be. I will tell your friend Mr. Dacco how to get there, and he will follow my instructions. What if you are arrested while you are traveling, Rini? Then not only would there be that trouble, but the authorities would clear the car's memory as well, and this place, whatever hope it may bring, would be known to them."
Rini nodded.
"Okay. Okay, you're right."
She looked across the parking lot, hoping to see Jeremiah already returning. Khabu leaned forward.
"May I ask a question?"
"Certainly."
"Is there nowhere else we could go besides this place which may be surrounded by soldiers? Are there not many businesses that have VR connections, or who would sell or rent us the necessary equipment?"
"Not for what we are speaking of,"
Martine replied.
"I am not sure even the best equipment at your polytechnic would have given you the level of response you need, and it certainly would not permit you to experience VR as long as may be necessary."
"Look, that's Jeremiah," Rini said suddenly, squinting at a distant figure.
"And he's running."
She set the pad on the car floor.
"Come on."
She hurried around to the driver's side. As she sat staring at the dashboard, trying to remember her driving lessons from years before, Khabu forced his way into the back seat, waking a protesting and grouchy Long Joseph.
"What are you doing?"
Martine's voice was muffled by the pad cover, which had fallen closed.
"We'll tell you in a minute. Stay connected."
Rini got the car started and seesawed out of the parking space, then headed toward Jeremiah. Forced to travel up and down rows of stationary cars, she had only moved them 100 feet closer when she pulled up alongside him. He clambered into the passenger seat, short of breath, and almost stepped on Rini's pad.
"What happened?"
"They took the credit card."
Jeremiah seemed stunned, as though this were the strangest thing that had happened so far.
"They were going to arrest me."
"Good God! You didn't use one of Susan's cards, did you?"
asked Rini, horrified.
"No, no. My card. Mine. They took it and waved it over the machine. Then they told me the manager needed to speak to me. He didn't come for a moment, so I just ran out. My card. How do they know my name?"
"I don't know. Maybe it was just a coincidence. This has all happened so fast."
Rini closed her eyes, trying to concentrate. "You'd better drive." They exchanged places. Jeremiah headed as rapidly as he could toward the parking lot exit. As they joined a line of cars funneling out past the front of the mall, 2 uniformed guards emerged, talking into their headset microphones. "Don't look," said Rini. "Just drive." As they pulled out onto the main thoroughfare, Jeremiah suddenly sat up straight.
"If they have my name, what if they go after my mother?"
He seemed on the verge of tears.
"That's not right. She's just an old woman. She hasn't done anything to anyone."
Rini put a calming hand on his shoulder.
"Neither have we. But don't upset yourself. I don't think anyone would do anything to her. They can't know for sure you're even involved with us."
"I have to get to her."
He pulled into a turn lane.
"Jeremiah, no!"
Rini reached for an authority she did not feel.
"Don't do it. If they're really looking for us that seriously, they'll be waiting for you to do just that. You won't do her any good at all, and we'll all be stuck then."
She forced herself to think.
"Look, Martine says she thinks she's found something, a place we can go. We need you to get us there. I'm sure you can make some arrangement for your mother."
"Arrangement?"
Jeremiah was still wild-eyed.
"Call one of your relatives. Tell them you've had to go out of town on some emergency. Ask them to keep an eye on her. If you stay away, whoever is after us won't have any reason to bother her."
She wasn't sure that was true, and she felt like a traitor for saying it, but she could think of nothing else. Without Jeremiah and the mobility of the car, she and Khabu and her father stood no chance.
"But what if I want to see my mother? She's an old woman. She'll be lonely and frightened."
"What about Stephen?"
Long Joseph said suddenly from the back seat.
"If they chase us and we hide, we can't go see my boy when that quarantine's done."
"For God's sake, I can't think of everything right now,"
shouted Rini.
"Everyone just shut up!"
Khabu's slender fingers reached over the seat and came to rest on her shoulder.
"You are thinking very well," he said. "We must do what we are doing. What you have said."
"I am sorry to interrupt,"
Martine said from the pad beneath Rini's feet, making her jump.
"But do you wish me to give you some directions?"
Rini rolled down the window and took a deep breath. The air was warm and heavy with the threat of rain, but at the moment it smelled like escape. The Ilosi was speeding northwest along the N3. For the moment, only another anonymous unit in the early thickening of the rush hour. Jeremiah had been able to reach an elderly relative and make arrangements for his mother's well-being, and Rini had dispatched business-like messages to Stephen's hospital and the Poly that would cover for her with both institutions for a few days. They had sprung themselves free, and seemed at least temporarily to have eluded their pursuers. The mood in the car was improving. Martine had set them a destination high in the Drakensberg range, along the Lesotho border, in an area too wild and with roads too primitive to be usefully explored in darkness. As the afternoon came on, Rini began to worry they would not be able to reach the area in time. She was not happy when Jeremiah decided to stop at a highwayside chain restaurant for lunch, reminding the others that they made an odd-looking party, and that Khabu in particular was bound to be remembered. She convinced Jeremiah to go in and order 4 meals to take away. He came back, complaining about having to eat while driving, but they had only lost a quarter of an hour. Traffic became more sparse as they ascended from the plain and into the foothills. The road grew smaller, and the vehicles grew larger as little commuter runabouts were replaced by huge trucks, silver-skinned dinosaurs making their way to Ladysmith or beginning the long haul to Johannesburg. The silent Ilosi slipped in and out between the bigger vehicles, some of whose wheels were twice as high as the car itself. Rini could not help but feel it was an all-too-accurate analogy for their own situation, the vast difference in scale between themselves and the people they had offended.
"Except it would be even more like what's going on,"
she noted unhappily,
"if these trucks were trying to run over us."
Luckily, the analogy instead remained loose. They reached the escort sprawl and turned west onto a smaller motorway, then left that after a short while for an even smaller road. As they climbed higher on the tightly winding mountain roads, the sun passed the noon midpoint, and then seemed to spiral down the sky, heading for the mantle of black thunderheads that shrouded the distant peaks. Signs of civilization were dwindling, replaced by grassy hillsides and swaying aspens, and increasingly dark stands of evergreens. Long stretches of these smaller roads seemed deserted, except for occasional signs promising that somewhere in the trees was hidden this lodge or that camp. It seemed that they were not only leaving Durban, but the very world as they had known it. The passengers had been silent for some time, caught up in the scenery, when Khabu spoke. "Do you see that?" He pointed to a high, square section of the looming mountains. "That is Giant's Castle. The picture, the cave painting in Dr. Von Blake's house, came from there." The small man's voice was strangely tight. "Many thousands of my people were driven there, trapped between the white man and the black man. This was less than 200 years ago. They were hunted, shot on sight. A few of their enemies they killed with their spears, but they could not win against guns. They were driven into caves and murdered. Men, women, children. That is why there are no more of my people in this part of the world."
No one could think of anything to say. Khabu fell into silence again. The sun was just beginning to pass behind one particularly sharp mountaintop, impaled like an orange on a squeezer, when Martine made contact again.
"That must be Kathkin Peak you are seeing," she said. "You are nearly to the turning place. Tell me the names of the towns around you."
Jeremiah named the last few they had passed through, unhappy little aggregations of second-hand neon and industrial refit.
"Good," Martine said. "In perhaps a dozen kilometers, you will reach a town named Peterkatsburg. Turn on the exit there, then take the first cross street to the right."
"How do you know all this, all the way from France?" asked Jeremiah.
"Survey maps, I think they are called."
She sounded amused.
"Once I discovered the location of this wasp's nest, it was not hard to find a route for you." "Really, Mr. Dacco, you act as though I were a sorceress."
Within minutes, as she had predicted, a sign appeared proclaiming the imminence of Peterkatsburg. Jeremiah turned off, then turned again at the cross street. Within moments, they were winding up a very narrow road. Kathkin Peak, shrouded in dark clouds and silhouetted by the vanishing sun, loomed high on Rini's left. She remembered the Zulu name for the mountains, Barrier of Spears. But at this moment, the Drakensbergs looked more like teeth, a vast, jagged, tusked jaw. She remembered Mr. Jay's and shivered. Perhaps Long Joseph had also been reminded of mouths.
"How are we going to eat out here?" he asked suddenly. "I mean, this is nowhere. Big nowhere."
"We picked up plenty of food from the store at lunch,"
Rini reminded him.
"Couple days' worth, maybe. But you said we running away, girl. We going to run away for 2 days? Then what?"
Rini bit back a snappish reply. For once, her father was right. They could certainly buy food in small towns like Peterkatsburg, but there was a real risk that strangers would draw attention, and certainly strangers who kept coming back again and again would be remarked. And what would they use for money? If Jeremiah's account was frozen, she and her father could expect nothing but the same. They would go through the cash they had with them in days.
"You will not starve," Khabu said.
He was talking to the father, but she sensed that he was speaking to her and Jeremiah as well.
"I have been little use so far, and that has made me unhappy, but there are no people better at finding food than my people."
Long Joseph raised his eyebrows in horror.
"I remember you talking about the kind of things you eat. You a crazy little man, you think that I'm going to put any of that stuff in my mouth."
"Papa, have you reached the next road yet?"
Martine asked.
"When you do, go past it and look for a track leading from the left side of the road, like a driveway to a house."
The food controversy, momentarily in abeyance, Jeremiah followed her instructions. A light mist had begun to dot the car windows. Rini heard thunder grumbling in the distance. The track looked narrow, but that was because it had become overgrown near the road. Once they were past the encroaching thorn bushes and had thoroughly scratched the Elosi's finish, almost bringing Jeremiah to tears again, they found themselves on a wide and surprisingly firm road that zigzagged steeply up into the mountains. Rini watched the deep woods roll by. Bottlebrush plants known as red-hot pokers stood out against the grayness, bright as fireworks.
"This looks like a wilderness area, but there weren't any signs, not to mention fences. It is government property,"
Martine said.
"But perhaps they did not want to draw attention with signs and barriers. In any case, I have called Mr. Singh on the other line. He will be able to help us through any perimeter security."
"Sure."
Singh's lined face appeared on the screen, glowering.
"I don't have anything better to do this week other than about 100 hours of cracking on this damned other land system.
A bend in the road abruptly revealed a gated chain-link fence blocking their way. Jeremiah braked the car, cursing under his breath.
"What you got there?" Sing asked. "Hold up the pad so I can see."
It's just a fence," said Rainey, "with a lock on it."
"Oh, I'll be a lot of help with that," he cackled. "Yeah, just turn me loose."
Rainey frowned and got out of the car, pulling up her collar against the light patter of rain. There wasn't a person in sight, and she could hear nothing but the wind in the trees. The fence sagged in places, and rust powdered the hinges of the gate, but it still made an effective barrier. A metal sign, all but scrubbed clean, still showed faint traces of the words, "Keep out." Whatever explanatory prose had accompanied the warning,